I had to laugh at the conference I've just been to listening to Rick. I think you can sit down, can't you? You can stand if you want. Listen to Rick when he started talking about dreaming, because I am a terrible dreamer. I really am a terrible dreamer. I go out my bike on a bike ride, and I love cycling, and you'll hear about that later on. When I get home, my wife says, "You've been a long time. Where have you been?" And I say, "I've got no idea." And I'm sure I would have stopped at traffic lights and let cars pass, but I get so deep in a thought, I find it hard to find out, you know, where I've actually been. And I bet I'm not alone. There's two things I really love talking about, and one of them is my love and my faith of walking with Jesus, my Creator. I became a Christian half my life ago. But the other thing I love talking about is business activity, particularly entrepreneurship. But I can't talk about one without talking about the other. They're really both important. You know, if I think back to, say, 25 years ago, the word entrepreneur was barely spoken. 10 years ago, you'd have heard it a little more often, but today, everybody wants to be one. But what is an entrepreneur? It's interesting. What is an entrepreneur? Well, I hope I can answer some of these questions as I go through. But more important, is an entrepreneur born or made? I've just asked someone just a few minutes ago that, and got the wrong answer, I think, but never mind. Entrepreneurship is not about just starting a company, having a good idea, just starting a company. It's what happens when things go wrong. And believe me, they will do. What do you do then? You've got to be really creative in solving those sort of problems. And to give you an illustration of exactly what I mean, I want to tell you a story about an Irish entrepreneur. I think it could be true, but this Irish entrepreneur, he had an idea, and he went down to the local Arab, and said, "Have you got any camels for sale?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "I've got this female camel. It's going to, give birth to a lot of nice-looking camels." And he said, "How much?" He said, $1,000. And he said, "No, it's too much." He said, "What else you got?" And he said, "I've got this male camel, still does a lot of hard work, $500. "No, sorry, too much." And he said, "Well, all I've got is this old camel. It's quite old. It can do half a day's work. How much is that?" $100. He said, "I'll take it." He said, gave him $100 to Arab, and he said, "Can you deliver it round to my house on Wednesday?" Well, when it came to Wednesday, Arab come round and knocked on his door and said to him, "Look, I've got two bits of bad news." He said, the old camel passed away in its sleep last night. And he said, "Oh, okay." He said, "Well, the other bad news is I've spent your $100 on broke. I can't pay you back." He said, "Well, that's no good. But look, bring the camel round, put it back around the backyard, and put a tarpaulin over it." Well, it would have been 6 months later when Arab was in Pack and Save. He was getting some dates, for tea. And he bumped into Mr. Murphy. He said, "Mr. Murphy, how did you get on with that camel?" He said, "Really good." He said, "I got my $100 back, plus I made $898 profit." He said, "How on earth did you do that?" He said, "Well, I sold 500 raffle tickets at $2 each." He said, "That's amazing. What about the person who won it?" He said, "He was really, really wild. I had to refund his $2 back." I'm not suggesting you try anything like that, but there's a principle there, isn't it, that you've got to be creative when something goes wrong. And I hope you understood it in that way. There's things in your life that I've been through, and no doubt you've been through, like obstacles, you may call them, or troubles, or real sadnesses, and it's how you overcome that will actually make you into the person you end up. It's always worth thinking about that. My father was in the British Army for 30 years. He was out in Burma, that's now Myanmar, and he was in Malaya, that's now Malaysia, and he served in India. He was at Dunkirk on the beaches. He was one of the survivors of Dunkirk. But my father moved, because he's in the army, I was born in Birmingham, we moved to a camp in there, and then we moved to Leicester in England. And then we moved, my brother was born, and my sister was born in Blackpool. And then we went and lived in Germany at a camp there for 3 years. I just went from school to school. I went to a lot of schools, and I didn't like it, because the moment you make friends, you're off again. My father retired after 30 years in the army, and he got this pension, and he bought a public house in Dover, which is the southeast of England, a seaport, which wasn't really a very good idea for him buying a pub, because he used to drink an awful lot. The pub didn't work out. He used to, when it's closing time, he would close the pub, then all his mates would come back and they'd have a little party, and you know, it's not the way you run a pub. And he wasn't really a businessman. So from that, he took a position. He went out to Cyprus, and that was in the years when I had a bit of trouble out in Cyprus as a prison officer. So we didn't see him. We didn't see him for years. And then one day, Mum said to us, "Dad's coming home." And we thought, Dad, okay. So we went up the local station to meet him off the train. And the whole family went up there, and I was with my younger brother. And as people got off the train, I thought, I think that's him. And no, this person walked right past. Well, then we thought, that must be him. Then that person walked right past. Then my father walked up behind my mum, gave her a kiss on the cheek and said, "Let's go home." And then we had to get to know our father all over again. And it was quite odd having him in the house because we weren't used to it. My father used to drink a lot, and that was probably his downfall, really, because he was quite a smart man. You'd have to be smart because he was a major when he retired from the army. We lived in a street in Folkestone. We moved from Dover to Folkestone, another seaside little town called Sydney Street, and that was the second roughest street in the town. When people asked where you come from, and you said Sydney Street, and I went, okay, you know. But there were gangs up the street, and these gangs were older than what we were, and we just had to avoid them. They chased us once across this paddock, and they kept shouting, "Stop," and there was no way we were going to stop. So one of them fired an arrow that stuck in my leg, and I had to go to the hospital and have it removed. That was a rough street. But I'm sure you understand that. But my father, I went to a school in England. I don't know how many people are from England. I'm going back quite a while. They used to have this 11-plus exam. And the 11-plus, you went from primary school, and if you were smart, you would go to the grammar school. But if you weren't smart, then you went to the other school and then they graded you from down there. But my father wanted me to follow his footsteps and go in the army. And quite frankly, I thought that was a good idea as well. I had to take this entrance exam, and I took it in the primary school where I was, and the teacher helped me a lot all the way through this exam and passed. Then I went for the interview and they took another exam and I failed. And I was really disappointed, but I said, well, that's the army. There's also the Air Force, so I applied to go into the Air Force and failed that. And then I thought, well, it only leaves the Navy, the Royal Navy, that is. So I applied and took this entry exam to go into the Royal Navy, and I failed that too. And my father was so disappointed with me, and quite frankly, I was disappointed with myself. I really wanted to go in one of those forces. But you know that failing, I've come to understand failing isn't the end of the world, it just sets you off in a different direction. And I'm sure some of you will understand that. As I grew up in Folkestone, in this rough street, with this gang I had to avoid, we used to have such a fun time. On the weekends or in holiday times, I'd get up early in the morning with my brother, we'd quickly grab something to eat, and then we'd go out all day and we wouldn't come home till the evening. We had some adventures. Oh, look, we really did. But one of the things I really loved doing was I've always enjoyed cycling. But my parents couldn't afford to buy me a bike, a new one, let alone a second-hand one. We would go over to the corporation rubbish dump when it was closed and no one was around, and they'd sort all this rubbish out. They'd have all that cast iron there and the steel there, but they had all the bike parts. And that's all we wanted. We wanted the bike parts. We'd go over there with our spanners and take wheels off. We made mountain bikes before they were invented, but put moped wheels on a bike. We'd bend the forks out. We just made it fit. But it was always a problematic going to this dump because it was pretty well run. But I had a caretaker that used to come around and check to see no one was taking stuff. And it wasn't a caretaker was worried about, it was his Alsatian. Because his Alsatian ran a lot faster than what we did, so we used to have the lookout. And when you saw the caretaker and then his Alsatian, and you just had to run for it and jump over the wall. But we used to make all our bikes up. But one time, I'm glad there's no children here while I say this, But one time when we was over there going through some of the other rubbish, we found a hand grenade. No, seriously, we found a hand grenade and it still had the pin in it. So, and you know, I've never held one before, but they're actually quite heavy. And where they burnt all the refuge, we went over there and said, see if it goes off. So we took the pin out and we threw it into the rubbish and we ran like anything. And I'm still here, so I can tell you it didn't go off. I used to have, we used to make like a box car. I know kids make them now, but ours was a giant thing. Ours carried six people. And it was dangerous. We used to have put one of our friends on the main road as we come down the alley, and when he put a white flag up, that means no cars were coming. We just put down because we couldn't stop, and we'd go right over. So we thought, this is a bit dangerous. Should put a brake on this car. Six of us would sit on this, and you had one person up the front steering it, and it would go really fast. We put a brake on it, but we put it on the back wheel, so the person on the back would put his foot up and press it as hard as he could. But that was problematic as well because it stopped that wheel, so the whole thing rolled out, the wheel came out, and we just lost a lot of skin. But one of the other things we used to do too, we were okay sort of swimmers, we're about 12 or 13. You probably don't know this, but in England, where we come from, the rise and fall of the tide is anything from 7 to 8 metres. It's a heck of a lot. So there's a lot of water comes up that English Channel, and a lot of water goes down. So when it's coming up, we'd get on the pier that was 2 kilometres long and we'd swim out and we'd catch the tide. We weren't very good swimmers and the tide would go in like this and we'd swim with the tide and we'd be going up and down under the water. We'd just keep swimming to the left and we'd end up like 3 or 4 or 5 kilometres down the beach and it was exciting. We used to do stuff like that. But something happened when I was 13. And you're going to find this hard to believe when I'm telling you this, because I find it hard even telling you. When I was 13 years old, my brother and his friend, Dennis, and we climbed up the cliffs. The cliffs were like 140 metres high. They're white cliffs. Now, if you climb up chalk, it's not like granite or anything like that. It's really powdery. If it's wet, it's a lot worse. It's very slippery. We would go up there and we'd collect seagulls' eggs. I had no idea why we got them, but we just did. And we'd get them in our pockets, and the seagulls would try and bombard you and knock you off the ledge. We got to the very top in this day, and it was one of those rare days in England where it was just a beautiful day. It was crystal clear, not a cloud in the sky. And on the top of the cliff, I was mesmerized. You could look right across the English Channel. You could see all the boats going up and down. And on the other side, you could see the French got white cliffs there. And I was just sort of looking at the cliffs there, and it was just... I don't know, it was just really interesting. Then my brother shouted out to me, come on, we're going down. And there was about 5 metres of this tussock grass. And I turn around and grab a piece of grass like this, another piece of grass, and then I lower myself down carefully. The first piece of grass I grabbed, I didn't grab enough. It broke off my hand. So I quickly grabbed another bit, the same thing. And before I could do it, I was sliding, and I knew what was going to come. I fell 140 metres, and I went way out. I hit the cliff once on the way down, and I landed, hit a tree, and I landed in a bush. And you know when people say that moments before you die, your whole life flashes before you? Mine didn't. All I thought about was it going to hurt when I hit? And do you know, when I hit that bush, the first thing I thought of, I was only 13, I'm dead. Mum's going to be really angry. I couldn't feel anything. I was stunned. I couldn't feel any pain, I couldn't hear anything, and it's just a really odd feeling. If I haven't experienced death, I thought this must be what it is. So I had this 13-year-old logic that if I could move my hand over slightly like this and pinch myself, if I felt that, I must be still alive. So I managed to wriggle and I got over and I pinched myself and I felt it, but at the same time, I felt everything. I felt the branches jammed in my shoulder, my back, the thorns. This was a thorn bush, I didn't say that. They were that big. Thorns that big, they were stuck through my ears, they're everywhere. And I couldn't move. My brother and his friend finally got down to the cliff where I was, thinking that I wasn't alive. And then someone who was hunting saw me fall down too, and so they ripped the bush apart, and eventually they got me out. They pulled thorns out of me, they got branches out of my back, I was just torn to pieces. but I didn't break anything. I didn't break any bones. I can't get over that, but they took me down to a campsite that was a kilometre or so away, and when I got there, they made me a hot cup of tea with four sugars in it, because you do that to someone who's nearly died, I think. And after a while, I didn't feel good, and I went into shock, and I just lay down and put a blanket over me, and eventually, after a while, I sort of came out of it, and I felt okay. So I got up and walked home. And I told my brother, don't say anything to Mum. Look, don't say anything. So she, you know, I didn't have to. I went in there, my face, I'd looked in the mirror, my face was torn to pieces. And for months, I'd have these big, like, boils on my skin, and it'd pop, and a thorn would come out. But that, I find hard to believe. I've been back to England, and I've gone to that point. I've looked up that cliff and thought, man, how did I get away with that? I can only tell you that I think the hand of God was there then, even then, watching over me. I used to have two paper rounds. We were poor kids. We never even had a bathroom. So, okay, I've got one now. But we didn't have a bathroom. We used to have a bath that I'm going back a long way. A big thing you used to put by the fire. And my little sister used to get in the bath first, and then my brother, he would get in the bath, and then I would have to get in the bath afterwards, which I didn't like that, because my brother, as he got out of the bath, he'd whisper to me, I've peed in the bath. And that put me right off really getting in it, you know. But I had these paper round in the morning, one in the evening, but I had a greengrocer around, and I'd make money. It was my money. I'd never got pocket money. You couldn't even think about pocket money. But I got my own money. But where most of my friends were going to spend the money on various things, I didn't. I didn't spend money at all. I used to go and buy rare English coins from a dealer. I was only 13. And I knew a collector who would pay money for them. So I'd go and bargain these coins at a price. And these coins, look, they'd cost me like a month or maybe 2 months of the wages I was earning at the time. It was a lot of money. But I knew how to make profit, and I knew I'd buy it for this, and I could sell it for that. That's got to be good. And so that's what I used to do. When I was 17 years old, I joined the Merchant Navy. Told you before, I couldn't get into any armed forces, but the Merchant Navy was much easier. I loved it. I loved it at sea. I worked on the cross-channel ferries as a young boy, and then I became eventually an able seaman, but I loved it. I loved the storms used to go through. They used to have some terrible storms in the English Channel. They really did. And sometimes you couldn't get into the port. You'd fill the boat up with passengers going out of Dover, and you'd go across the English Channel. You couldn't get into Calais, and you'd go up and down, and half the passengers would be sick as anything, and you'd bring them all back to Dover again, which really wasn't ideal. But I was on a boat that even sunk in the harbour of Dover, which was really, really quite. I met a lot of interesting people. But the plan was that when you'd been on the ferries for the season, at the end of the season, all the young, what they called us deck boys, would hand a notice in. They'd go up to the shipping pool in London, and you'd get a ship, and it'd take you around the world. Maybe some of you may have done that. And my brother was going to go, and his friends, all our friends, all the young deck boys. Well, that wasn't going to be for me, because that very week, something happened. It changed my whole life. I've read somewhere there's three major decisions you'll make in your life that would change your whole life. This, what I'm telling you, was not a major decision. It was probably one of the most insignificant decisions I've ever made, but it just changed my life. I had a Triumph motorbike, because Triumph motorbikes are real motorbikes, and I'd taken my friend for a ride. We'd gone up to a cafe uptown. I said, okay, let's take you home. So I drove around the town. I said, once more around the town. That was the decision I made. As I went around the town, this car had, this young fellow was in it, dropped some girls off, and he accelerated away to impress these girls and plowed straight into us. My foot smashed the bumper. It hit it so hard, it split my boot open. My knee went right through the headlamp, and it scooped a big lump out of my knee. I lost part of my kneecap, and I smashed my hand. My hand was crushed both here and up here. My friend on the back broke his leg in that many places. It was terrible. But something happened. that the injury was bad enough to put me not in my local hospital, but one out of town, a bigger hospital, so I'd get the proper treatment. I had a lot of operations on my hand to restore it, but it's pretty messed up. But while I was in hospital, and I had my hand in plaster, my hand got infected and it went black. And they said, you're going to lose half your hand. Well, I was only 17 years old. That was the last thing I wanted. But a young girl used to come and see me in hospital every day, and she used to cheer me up. I'd met her once before. Didn't know her that well, but she lived in the area where my parents used to come once or twice a week because it meant a bit of traveling, and my friends were the same. She used to come and see me every day. And some days I was in so much pain. I mean, I wouldn't have been very nice, but she used to come every day. She was carefree, bring me stuff and stuff. After 3 months, we really got to know each other. So when I got out of hospital, I'd never had a girlfriend before. And I was only 17 and I was really shy. But I asked her, would you go out with me? And so we went out together for a while. And wow, I got married to her. So it's funny the way things work around. So when I say that insignificant decision that I made once more around the town changed my whole life, I tell my daughter and my granddaughters and sons, if I hadn't gone once more around the town, I would never have married your grandmother. I'd never have married, you wouldn't have, you know, had the children we'd had, and so you wouldn't be here. So, and I think they understand that. When I worked on the ferries, I really liked it on there a lot as a seaman. I just loved the weather, and we'd load cars on there, we'd load passengers. But I was just a real trader, I just couldn't help it. In the 8 years while I lived in England, I'd owned over 40 cars. I had four cars, and it wasn't because I'd drive them all. I'd go out to the market, buy them, clean them up, and sell them. It just seemed a natural thing for me to do. I'd go to some of the markets, and I'd buy clothes that had been, damaged in a fire slightly. It got water damage in a fire. I'd buy all these clothes, all these shirts, all these trousers. And when we would go to France, I'd lay them all out of my bunk, all on the side. I'd get the French porters down, and I'd actually sell them. And I found out something very interesting, that when I used to say they would try a pair of trousers on, they would never try them on. They'd done the top button up, pulled the waist like this, and put it around their neck. And if it touched, that was the size that would fit them. How many people know that? Okay, there's a few of them. Well, I didn't know that anyway, but I thought it was really interesting. And when I used to sell the crew watches, I'd sell them paint because I had a contact, I've got paint, I'd sell the crew. I'd sell a couple of them for cars, but I used to sell them ex-army boots. They were an army boot that was ex-army. It's been all worn, so it's easy to wear, and they're all good safety boots. But I'd sell anything I saw a profit in, I'd sell. And I just loved doing it. I really enjoyed my life, you know, on the ferries and how things were going, but it soon came to an abrupt end. Our second daughter, Lucy, I come home from work one night, and well, not night, I've been working all night, I come home in the morning, my wife was upset, she said, I've been up all night, our baby Lucy, she's something wrong with her, she's not very well, she's not breathing properly, and I was so tired, I just had to just lay down. I laid down for a little while, like an hour, and she woke me up again, shook me, and said, come and look at the baby again. So I went in, and she was quite bad, so we phoned the doctor up, and she got taken into hospital, and she died that day. And you know, naive maybe I was, but I never thought things like that could happen to me. I thought those sort of things just happened to other people. It was a really hard time for us. I had no support, really. I was just on our own. It brought us closer together. But the only way I could overcome that, which I know it's not the best way, was never talk about what happened. Never talk about it, and we didn't for years. It just would bring the whole memory of that again back. I'd worked on the ferries for about 12 years, and the alcohol you could buy on the ferries was really cheap. I mean, it was just really cheap. When I'd had too much to drink one night, someone said to me, you're a chip off the old block. And you know what he means by that. You mean you're like your dad. And that's a very personal, I didn't want to be like, because I could remember my father coming home and shouted at my mum when he was drunk, and his kids would put the pillow over your head so you couldn't hear. I didn't want to be like that. I didn't want to be like that at all. So I wanted to change my life. And it just started to make me feel really unsettled. I used to come home and say to my wife all the time, let's go to New Zealand, because I worked with some fellows who had actually gone to New Zealand. Let's go to New Zealand. But she would always say, no, she's very close to her mother. But one night I came home and I said, let's go to New Zealand. I'll say it all the time. And she'd say, okay. I went, woo, okay, I wasn't expecting this. I'd really think about if I really wanted to go. And but look, as things turned out, it was something we'd both, told our parents we're just going to go for 12 months. And it was 12 years before we ever went back for a visit. We liked it straight away. We never thought of returning back to England. We never thought that. But the year I came, in 1975, was the first year you had an entry permit. You had to apply to come. And my friend was going to come as well, bring all his family. He got turned down, and I got accepted, which was really unusual until I'll tell you a little bit of the story later on. I came to New Zealand looking for a new life, and that's exactly what I found. I got a job building caravans under contract. I would put the lino down in a van, I'd put the furniture in it and bolt the roof on. And you got paid a contract price, and I'm going back to like 1980, you got paid $17.50 for fitting one. And one van took me 2 days, and I wasn't going to keep us. That's $17 split over 2 days, it wasn't enough. But I figured out that a lot of the work I was doing was just really easy work. So I employed this schoolboy, and he would paint all the, you know, boards, and he would put all the tape on, and he would do all this donkey work, which meant I could then do 4 vans in 1 day, which was a lot better. We'd done a lot better from that. But I'd done that for quite a while, but I worked with a chap there, was from England too, and he asked me, will I go to church with him on Sunday evening? And I said, no, I don't do church. And I said, why are you going? Because I knew he didn't go anyway. He wasn't a Christian. And he said, my wife's getting baptized. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, as far as I know, they've got this like tank of water in a church, and she gets in it, and I asked her, do you believe in Jesus? And she says, yes, and I push her head under. And I said, you've got to be joking. What, in front of everybody else? He said, yeah. And I said, okay, I will come. when I went to church, I was really surprised. The people who were there, do you know they're ordinary people? I don't know what I was expecting to see, but it wasn't what I was. A lot of young people there. The pastor was younger than what I was. And it just surprised me. But it was something I heard him said. He explained what sin was in a person's life. I got that. I figured, yeah, I'm one of those. Then he said that your sin has separated you from God. And I didn't like that. Though I didn't really believe in God. I sort of used to pray for him a couple of times when I got in serious trouble, when I needed some help. But I didn't really believe in him. So it challenged me enough to just kind of sneak back there in the evening, just as the church had started. So I can sit in the back. As soon as it's over, I was out the door. And so I just wanted to try and work it out for myself. But one day when I came out of the church, this young Māori high school teacher, he was 10 years younger than me, he came up to me, tapped me on the shoulder. He said, my name's Peter. I said, how do you, Peter? He said, would you like to do a Bible study? And I thought, oh, gee whiz, I don't want to do this. Go on, think. And he didn't say anything, so someone had to say something. And I could think, oh, come on, think. Okay, that'd be a lovely idea. And, you know, I can't even remember saying those words. I'm sure I didn't really. But you know, it turned out to be a good idea. We studied the Bible for 3 or 4 months. And we would, anything I'd ask him, he would say to me, he wouldn't tell me what he thought, he'd open the Bible up and say, look, that's what it says here. And I said, oh, okay. After 3 or 4 months, he asked me this. He said, do you now believe the Bible is the Word of God? I said, do you know? Yes, I do. He said, do you believe Jesus was the Son of God? And I said, yes, I do. He said, do you believe Jesus came upon this earth, walked this earth to save you? And I thought, oh, okay. Well, one thing I do know, you have 2 major events in your life. The first one, of course, is when you're born. But the next one is figuring out why. Why are you born? And I haven't figured that out. I think a lot of people go through life never figuring that out. But that was the day I figured out while I was born, and it was to accept Jesus as my Savior. And I asked him to hold my hand for the rest of the journey. That's And he's done that. He's held my hand for the rest of the journey and all the things I've been through. There may be some of you here that haven't kind of reached that point of asking Jesus to hold your hand for the rest of the journey, but God's made it pretty easy, I reckon. He's hasn't given us a whole library to find out the answers. We just got one book. And you can go through that book and read it, and you'll find the answers there. So searching, if anyone's here that hasn't searched, you need to search. It's kind of like if you do a jigsaw puzzle, you get right to the very end, and there's 10 pieces missing. You think, well, it's the 10 pieces. Shake the box, and 5 pieces drop out. So you put those in, you see the picture. It's a little bit clearer now. And you think, where's the rest of them? And you look all around. You know you haven't moved fast. You go down the side of the sofa, and you find another 3 pieces. You pop those in. And you look down, and underneath your shoe, one of them stuck in. You put that in. The last one, you find inside your shoe. And you put it in, then you get the whole picture. It's searching is like that. Like once you find, see the whole picture, how can you not accept Jesus' irresistible love? I don't know if you can do that. You can't. It's irresistible, isn't it? I just want to leave you with one thought, that when someone told me once that if I got a pen, and I can't quite see it, but I drew a little dot on the backboard there, and you said, can you see that? No, I can't. So you get close and close till you can see it. And you said, pretty small. I said, that's your life. That little dot's your life. And I said, well, it's pretty small. Then you get that pen, and you drew a line all the way around and join it up again. That is eternal life. It doesn't finish, it just keeps going and going around. I think you should do that as a church, actually. Just put a line all the way around here. Makes a good talking point, doesn't it? Peter didn't leave me once he helped me to find the Lord. He helped me to study the Bible for myself. He taught me, discipled me. He taught me how to pray. That was foreign to me. I'd never prayed. I didn't know what to pray. I didn't know how to pray, but he helped me to pray. He helped me to memorize verses. And he said, well, memorize 2 verses a week. I said, can't do that. He said, why? I said, I've got good memory. He said, what's your address in England before you came out here? What's your parents' names? What's your phone number? And he asked me, he said, nothing wrong with your memory. So we started memorizing verses, which is something I still do now. He helped me have a quiet time in the morning. He'd come round to my house 6:30 in the morning and meet with me for the whole week till established it. Then come the scary part. He said, we're going to go downtown at lunchtime and we're going to ask people, we're going to share our faith with people. I said, what do you mean share your faith? He said, tell them about Jesus and how you became a Christian. I said, oh, I don't know about that one. That's a bit scary. But we did. We'd have a little clipboard. We'd go down and someone's having a lunch. You'd sit down alongside them and said, can I ask you a few questions? And people love to be asked questions. And we'd ask you, do you believe in God? No. Do you believe? And you ask a few, you know, questions like that. And before you know it, the clipboard's down and having a conversation with them. We done that. And I actually kind of like that, really. And I've done it ever since. But one thing that I started to recognize when I became a Christian, and that was, I'd never read a book. I didn't like reading. It was just hard. I wanted to read now. I wanted to read the Bible. I wanted to read books about the Bible. So I saw this little classified ad in our local paper, and it said adult reading classes. And I thought, I wonder what that is. So I got enough courage up, and I went down to this place, and they assessed my reading, which was pretty low. And then they put me with a retired principal, a woman, who became my mentor. And I went and met her, and she said, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're going to have a little notebook, any words you don't understand, write them down, and bring a book you want to read. Now, you might think this is odd, but I wanted to read about George Whitefield, who was a 15th century preacher in England. I bought volume 1 of Dalmore's book, 1,800 pages. I had absolutely no idea I was going to read this book, but I just wanted to start reading it. So after a couple of weeks, I'd start reading it. She said, something wrong with your eyes. I said, why? She said, you're reading words that aren't there. I said, oh. So I went and got my eyes tested, and they were fine. The optician said, why did you come? What do you want your eyes tested for? So I told him. He said, you need to go and see this fella. So I went and saw someone else, and he didn't do the same eye test for me. He'd done a whole lot of coordination things. And then in the end, he said, you're dyslexic. Well, not only had I never heard of the word, I didn't even know how to spell it, but I understand what it is now. And back then, once I understood, it kind of made a bit of a difference that it wasn't that I was failed all those exams at school because I was bad at science or maths or anything like that. I actually couldn't read the questions very well. But now I wanted to read. And in that 1800 book, I actually finished that. And I got onto volume two. And it's a great book, by the way. George Whitford, you've got to read about what happened in his year, how God transformed England through his ministry. Reading now is my passion. I'm really slow. I would never read a book in the same room as my wife because she turns 10 pages to my one. So I don't do that. But the strangest thing is, everything I read, I can remember it. And it's probably because it takes a long time to sink in. I've read books about American history. I love reading about people. So I read a lot, and I really enjoy it. My friend I was in the Merchant Navy with, John, he came out to visit me. And I was a Christian, and I was really thinking about, I know what he's like, this fella. You know, he would make fun of me. I know all these things. So when I met him from the Auckland airport, the first thing he gave me, thrust forward to me, was a litre bottle of Rombacardi rum. So I'd accept it. It was a present. But when he left, he took the rum back with him. He said, I'm sure you're not going to read it. But his parting words to me at the Auckland airport was, for goodness sake, come back to England and get back to normal. You're going to find it very odd what I'm going to say now. But Robert Muldoon, do many of you remember him? He used to be a prime minister a long time ago. Interesting character. He helped me start my first business. And you know how he helped me? I was building caravans, which I just mentioned a little bit before. And in their wisdom, the government's wisdom, they put a sales tax on caravans and boats, all luxury items, 25%. Wasn't a little bit. It killed the industry overnight. So I was made redundant. So that's how I got into business. He gave me the push I needed, and I'm very grateful of it. I started a furniture business, and I love furniture. I love designing. I used to design this furniture, this Scandinavian furniture. I'd seen in England, and I put it on a trailer, a table and six chairs, take it up to the town in Hamilton, sell it to a shop, carry it in, they pay me, I come home. By the time I got home, got a phone call, one another table and chairs. And I was doing this in my basement. I'm a really keen cyclist, and I just bought myself this Italian lightweight racing bike, and I had to sell it to buy a bandsaw machine that I needed. But after a while, the business grew, and I shared a workshop with someone who made toys on a weekend, and I made furniture on during the week. And after a while, it grew again. And so I employed a few staff. I think we had about 8 staff. And then tragedy struck. That one night, I had this workshop and had a little shop on the front in Frankton, in Hamilton. And I had a phone call, said, there's a fire in your factory, 10 o'clock at night. I said, okay, I'll pop down. He said, wait. I said, what? He said, it's bad. Well, it's bad, all right. I got down, and the whole road was closed off with 6 fire engines. I could see the glow over Frankton as I drove down there. I got down, I couldn't believe it. But I rushed in, and everything was gone. Everything was burned. Everything. I didn't know what to do, you know. So the fire brigade helped me, you know, after put the fire out, you have to board all the building up. And I went home, didn't sleep all at night. And I drove to work the next day, and some of the staff there, but my bank manager was there. And I thought, man, that's really thoughtful of him to come down here. But the first thing he asked me, are you insured? You know, he didn't care much about where I went. He just wanted to know if he was going to get his money. But that was a really interesting time for me because I had a decision to make. Because it was just before Christmas, I was underinsured and I had a lot of stock. So the insurance money that I would get, it was just enough to clear my debts. I'd still lose my house, but I would actually be able to go out and get a job. So that's one of the, or could I get going again? And I decided I'm going to get going again. I'm going to beat this. So I got another warehouse and started making furniture. But something interesting happened. When the fire was bad, it was really bad. The concern for the fire brigade was next to a paint shop. That's pretty bad. But next to the paint shop was a petrol station. So you can see it was pretty bad. So I got going again, insurance money would come through, and I'd got a lot of new machinery. But there was one day the insurance money would just dribble through, and I phoned up the insurance company. I said, look, I need some funds for, I've got to pay wages. And they said, look, the computer's down, we can't do it this week, it may be the week after. So I went down to the bank and said, can you help me out? No, we can't help you out. So I didn't know what to do after that. So when I went back to my factory, I sat in my office, my head in my hands, and I was thinking to myself, oh, what should I do? What should I do? And my friend popped in, my Christian friend. He's a little older than what I was. And he said, how are things going? I said, oh, you know, they're a bit tough. He said, okay. And he prayed with me. And that was fine. We prayed together. And they left. Then 5 minutes later, I don't know why he ever done this. 5 minutes later, he came back in. He opened his checkbook up and said, how much you want? I said, 20,000. He wrote it out, gave it to me and left. That's amazing. Still now, as I said, I get a lump in my throat. And I was over to pay him back in 6 months' time. I took it down to the bank and they had no idea where I got it from, and I wasn't going to tell them either. We introduced the flexi slats, that's already been mentioned, into New Zealand. I saw an interesting market there. But we also used to make medical beds. We'd make hospital beds that were wider than a normal bed. They were made for people who were paralyzed. And they were just so much wider. We used to put electric motors on this, the bed would lift up and down, tilt back and forwards. It gave anybody who was paralyzed independence. Very, very rewarding. On two occasions, I came home from work where things hadn't gone well, and someone owed me a lot of money, and I got out of business, and I said to my wife, it's all over. I've lost the house, I've lost everything. And we'd sit down and we'd weep together and pray, and in the morning, I'd have another idea, and off I'd go, and I managed to survive again. Business, I know a lot of you in business here, you know what I mean, it can be really, really tough. My wife, Gina, has never ever stopped me doing any of my harebrained ideas. She just always supported me. In fact, you probably won't get this, what I'm going to say next, but it makes a difference to me. She paid me a really, really good compliment, I should say. Now, when you get a compliment, it's not what said's important, it's who says it. And this is my wife, who I've got a lot of respect for, which I trust. She knows me, I think, better than myself. She just knows me really well. I just read this book about Benjamin Franklin. He lived 250 years ago in the States. His father took him out of school when he was 10. He said, this boy has no aptitude for anything. It's pretty odd, isn't it? Because he became America's greatest statesman. He negotiated the War of Independence with France and England. He was an entrepreneur. He was wrote books. He was a businessman. This bloke left school when he was 10. It was just amazing. You should read the book. But one of the things he used to do, he used to have this little glass tube with this little thing, and he'd wind it like that. Electricity, you go one terminal to another terminal, just jump back and forth like that. And he was fascinated, and he looked at this electricity, and he said, as fascinated as this is, I can't see whatever commercial value this would ever be. He's talking about electricity. Back then, it was 100 years later before it did. I read that book, and I'd read an article about if there wasn't anything, energy like electricity, just say you couldn't use it ever again, what would you use? And I used to think, oh, maybe to use gravity. That's that energy we're not using. I thought about that, and I come up with these ideas. So I said to my wife, Gina, I said, what do you think if we use gravity? What do you think if we've done this and done that? What do you think? Come on, what do you think? What do you think? Tell me what you think. And she looked at me and studied me for ages. And she looked at me, and I was waiting for a reply. The reply was a little long coming. I started to feel a little uncomfortable standing there. And she said, she looked at me in the face and said, do you know, you're really, really not normal, are you? do you see that could be a compliment or not? I love cycling. I like cycling a lot. I love road cycling. If you looked how much I'd cycle every week, every month, every year, and the last 25 years, I've been 3.5 times around the planet. What do you think about that? Now, I know some of you may be thinking, what a boring thing to do, you know. What a waste of time sitting on a bony little seat on a road, just pedaling like this. But, you know, I do some of my best thinking. It's a really good help for stress. It keeps me fit. And in 10 days' time, I'm doing a 300-kilometre charity bike ride in Thailand, which I'm looking forward to. Not the weather, because it's the middle of their summer. but I'm looking forward to it. In 2004, I sold my furniture business, which was the same time when my son, Luke, finished his business degree, and we started this company, Torpedo 7. It was really good. I've always wanted to work with my children, and fortunately, as we started Torpedo 7, not only did I work with my son, my daughter came and worked for us. My son-in-law, Ray, who's an extraordinary, talented fellow, worked for us. My granddaughters worked for us. We never organized like that. It just happened. We started Torpedo 7, and it went really, really well. Luke, my son, is like me. He's entrepreneurial. He's creative. But he's really good at researching and finding out stuff. He'd buy all the stuff. He was the one who said, let's start Torpedo 7. Let's import this stuff, parallel import it. So we got it going, and we started with mountain bikes, and then almost when we started, disaster was going to strike because we bought three-page advertising in a local, mountain bike magazine. And this fellow was excited. Not many people buy three-colour pages in a magazine. And we sent a copy through to him to put in. He said, your phone back. He said, I can't put this in. I said, what's wrong with it? It's good quality. He said, quality's fine. He said, I can't put it in. We said, why? He said, your prices are far too cheap. Although that was a good thing to hear, it was a stumbling block for us. If we can't put it in a mountain bike magazine, how can we let the people in New Zealand know what we're doing? So the budget we had for marketing, we split it up into like weeks and days, and we built it into the price we're going to sell it, so we reduced the prices. You can follow that. Reduce the prices. So we didn't have a really good price, didn't have an amazing price. We had unbelievable prices. So if you were a road cyclist and you bought tyres at $99 and your fellow you're cycling with says you can buy that same tyre for $39, what are you going to do? I mean, it was a really interesting business model. We grew from cycling to snow to adventure, water sports, motocross, which turned out to be a really good category, and fishing. We would sell, in one promotion, in 24 hours, 3,000 bike tires. Or we would sell 1,000 tool kits. We just sold lots of stuff. Then we decided we wanted to start one day. And we put a lot of planning into one day and how it was going to work. My son did a lot of research, and then we got the bank together. And we said, hey, look, Torpedo 7's going good. We're just about breaking, but we can start this other company called One Day. I said, you're crazy. What do you want to do? Why do you want to risk everything here with One Day and start, in Torpedo 7, and start One Day? And we said, oh, we just got a good feeling about this. So they said, look, don't do it. We discouraged them to do it. There's a big mistake. And so we listened to everything they said, and we done it. And it was absolutely amazing. Even from the forecast we started with, it was just simply amazing, just the journey we went on. I'll give you an example. You know those Chubba Chubba lollies, the little lolly on a stick? You get a little container of 60. We'd sell 11,000 in 24 hours. We sold, I love saying this one because it's 6.5 tons of marshmallows. Have you any idea how many pallets that is? It's a lot. We would sell 2,500 of women's shoes, but I can't get that one. But in 6 months, we'd sell 20,000 pairs of men's underpants. Now, I've got no idea what some of these men do with it. Maybe they just burn them after they use them. I don't know. But we used to have a lot of fun with our staff. We used to have a lot of fun. I took two bank officials, the National Bank, which it was then. They walked through our warehouse. I was showing them. And as I walked through, I said, hello, Bert. Hello, Bill. Hello, Mary. They said, do you know all your staff? I said, yeah, most of them. They said, that's amazing. But you know it's really not, is it? It's not amazing at all. But as they came round, something really special happened. And I'll mention it because I still think of it today. As we walked past where we used to pack all the one-day stuff, my granddaughter, Eden, was there. And she must have been 15 at the time, and she saw me. So she didn't care who I was with. She came up and embraced me and just hugged me. And you know, when a grandchild does that, it tells you how much they love them. I don't care who else is there. That was really special. I went from feeling really special to totally embarrassed because I took them into the the office, and I said, over there's our customer service, and that's our buying team, and that's, and I pointed her back. There was like an alcove. We used to chuck all our web builders there, you know, because they were a little different. And and as I pointed over, I said, that's our web team over there. The fellow who run the web team saw me pointing, and he sat up like this and blew me a kiss. You know, and I felt so embarrassed, I thought. And he, both these bank officials looked at me and thought, what's going on here? But I said, look, they're a bit odd over there anyway, you know, so pass that one off. Luke's birthday. One of the things I'd done with Luke, and I'd done this ever since he got his degree, was we'd go and have breakfast on a Tuesday morning, and after breakfast, we'd sit in the car, we'd walk around the lake, and we'd pray together. We've done that for 17 years. We just pray about everything. It's, although we work together, there's sometimes you don't have a time to really talk to one another. So we pray about it, and we've done that, like, we're still doing it now. It was his birthday, and as we came back to work, we parked the car, walked across the car park talking, didn't notice his blinds were, you know, pulled. Walked around his office, didn't know his door was closed, really, didn't pay any attention. Opened his door, and it was his birthday, remember, and someone had put two goats in his office. I mean, real goats in his office. One was on the desk eating something. Now, you would have thought that would have taught us a lesson, wouldn't you? The next year, same thing, walked across car park, went in there, opened the door, someone put two donkeys in there. Seriously, two donkeys had got a horse float, and everyone comes, surprised. One of his donkeys was incontinent too. We'd have a lot of celebrations. We just really enjoyed our staff. We'd have a meeting every month where I'd tell them, this is what we've done, this is what we can do next month, and then we'd buy more curry for lunch. If anyone said they didn't like curry, they got a final warning letter, because it was serious. No, I'm joking, really. I didn't want to do that. But we just really enjoyed our staff a lot. One of the things I used to do at the end of the day, and I used to fret about doing this, we'd do the same sort of meeting in December, just before everyone broke up. I talk about the whole year we've had, the year that we're going to have, and I'd spend 5 minutes telling them why they should consider Jesus at this time of the year. Then I'd ask for their permission to pray for them, and no one said no, so I did. And I used to do that every year, but no one made me do it. I just knew I had to do it, because I used to think this, if I don't tell them, who's going to? Who am I going to leave it up to? Yeah. See, it just put pressure on me to do it. In 2013, the warehouse group approached us, and they wanted to buy our business. We weren't keen at first, but look, as time went on, we negotiated. They bought 51%. And then we ran it for a while, and then they put their own manager in, so we sold it down, and eventually we sold the whole lot. We started in 2004 with four staff, and when we sold to the warehouse, we had 360. That's a lot of people. There's a lot of people. But look, we kind of knew them all. We used to have such a lot of fun with them. If you ask me what I'm doing right now, we involved in a bit of property. I still work very closely with my son, Luke. We bought a bit of property that we sort of play around with. We invest in businesses. We bought two travel companies from Trade Me, Travel Bug and Book It, and we run those in Hamilton. We bought a business up in Auckland, a finance company. Finance is difficult, I can tell you, but I'm still learning about it. But I find it fascinating, and I still have my breakfast meetings with him and praying about everything we're doing. But just right now, I'm not going to tell you to say too much about this, because I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. Secretly, in 2012, just before we sold to the warehouse, I had this idea, and this idea of a bike that could travel on water. And I'm not talking about something that floats and you can pedal along. I'm talking about something that moves fast. A hydrofoil bike. All I want to say to you, that this journey is absolutely amazing. It really is. Just how it's happened. I didn't know I was capable of doing anything like this. I didn't even know it was going to work. It's remarkable. I was going to say unbelievable, but you can't say that as Christians, can you? Because in God, everything's believable. You can't say it's unbelievable. I've just got a video, and it's a teaser video. It's only 25 seconds that I just want to show you now. That's what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. What do you reckon on that? That bike does 22 kilometres now. That's on Karapiro Lake. It's amazing. I was riding it in the waterways in Paumanui earlier this week. It really is amazing. But I want to finish now with one parting thought, and I'm running out of 15 seconds. I can't say it in 15 seconds. I'm sorry, but I'm coming to an end. If I had a time machine in my garage, I could have. You don't know that. But if I had a But I've had a time machine in my garage, and I said to you, jump in that time machine, I set it forward to 65 years. You may come out and meet yourself when you're 65, okay? So you're still the same age now, you meet yourself at 65. Who do you want to meet? Who do you want to meet? Why don't you, some stage, spend a bit of time and figuring out who do you want to meet? It won't be someone who lives on their own, who's not looked after themselves, or who's, you know, poor. It won't be that, will it? We all know that. It's going to be someone who's had a very successful marriage, that loves their partner as much as they did when they first met them, that they've got kids that love being around them and grandkids. You've helped a lot of people on the way. Maybe you've written some books. You've done some great things. It's going to be that. So a good exercise. Now, you could say this was homework, if you like. Okay? I want it done by tomorrow. No, I'm joking. But why didn't you do that? Figure out where you're going, because most people in life got no idea where they're going. But if you do know, it makes a lot of difference. Thank you.